This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
This episode of the Sportsman's Nation is brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is a social media platform designed for and by outdoorsmen. Go Wild is a place to connect with other outdoorsmen, find fishing and hunting tips and tactics, and you can even research and buy your gear. Join hundreds of thousands of other hunters, fishermen, and outdoorsmen and experience what this community is all about. Download it today at downloadgowild.com.
Welcome back to another episode of the Woodsman Podcast, where we'll talk everything Pennsylvania outdoors. If you enjoy deer hunting, fishing, trapping, or just being outside, this podcast is for you. Our goal is to showcase the vast opportunity that the Pennsylvania woodsman can experience. We hope this inspires you to get out and enjoy God's creation in the Keystone State. We are pumped up and ready to go for archery season. We're less than a month away for our state opener. Bows tuned in. All our final touches are made. I'm pumped, guys. I hope you are too. Whatever it may be, get out there and enjoy creation. We're getting close to that time of year when we're starting to see leaves change, cooler temperatures. It's a great time to be out. This week we're going to be talking with John Wakefield at the Game Commission. John is the fire program manager, and One thing I'd really like to do here at the Woodsman Podcast, I want to integrate state agencies and the management plans for our public land onto this podcast. I think there's a lot of great people in our state agencies, and I would like to incorporate them and use the information they have and the things within the plans to our advantage in whatever quarry we are going after in the outdoors here. So since it's so close to bow season, I wanted to touch on a couple things before we get into the nitty-gritty details of fire. First, we're going to be talking with John about, you know, all things fire, a little bit of the how-tos, the habitat types, the overall goals that the state has in place for the fire program, and a little bit of where it's going. So all things about fire, your curiosities, tune in here in just a little bit. But since we're so close to bow season, I wanted to talk about fire and how to utilize fire units on state land for hunting strategy. So your habitat type is a big deal. If the fire was utilized in an early succession, and when I say early succession, I'm talking maybe it was burned in the growing season in an old field, it was old shrub land, something that was younger, and that stuff was set back, and it was burned this year in 2021. Those are going to be fantastic places for you to utilize as a food source, because there's going to be so much herbaceous growth, and it's all going to be relatively available for the first part of archery season. So I like to approach those places as a food plot. Do you necessarily hunt over the food plot? Sometimes it calls for it, but keep in mind, while fire units are going to be highly attractive places for wildlife, they're also going to be highly attractive for people, because, you know, there's a lot of people that are going to think just the same things that you and I are thinking. If it's close to the road, if it's easily accessible, it could very quickly, within the first week, become a nighttime location for deer traffic. And if that happens, you need to shift gears and think, okay, this is a nighttime food source, but I can be almost certain deer are going to be relating to this unit for food. Go to the places that nobody else will go and find the security cover that they are bedding in. It might be 200 yards away, it might be 1,000 yards away, but find where you're where those deer are relating to that. You can either hunt them in the bed, or if you can find a transition or a pinch point that's leading them, that's going to be your best bet to move in for a kill. If these chop-offs were older, I say chop-offs, if these prescribed fires were older, 2-3 years, kind of look at those like a chop-off. When you get to year 2, 3, 4, 5, you're going to have a lot of herbaceous growth that you're going to start to get that mix of woody regeneration. You won't get this in a field, but if you have this in a woodland early succession type of habitat, you're going to see a lot of those browse species, and I say browse species, fall winter browse species coming back. They're going to start to take over the herbaceous stuff, and that'll be a good mix of cover and fall winter food. Again, I say if there is any place that's easily accessed, you may find more deer relating to it at night, or you may find more doe groups that linger on the edges. Most of the time, you're going to find a good buck is going to relate to that neck of the woods just on the backside, just where they're out of reach of that traffic of humans. Try to find a pinch point in between. The deer are going to relate to it, yes, but try to find the next security cover, that transition zone where you can capitalize. So hopefully that's something that you can think about as you're going through. When you get to these openings, I will caution you this. When you get to an opening in woods, so if it's a hardwood setting, but now there's a woodland that was chopped, then they came through with a prescribed fire. These openings, they're so tempting to sit by because it's a great edge transition. But what you'll find, especially in terrain, this will be exacerbated, wind is going to swirl like an eddy. Anybody that is a fisherman and, you know, talks about pools and, you know, that drift back when water goes over an edge, wind is going to swirl on those edges with the trees, especially with the leaves on. So keep in mind, if you set up on the edge of this quote-unquote food plot, which is really the burn unit, your wind could easily be swirling depending on your direction. It could hit that wall, back swirl, and any deer that comes into that unit could smell you, even if you think you have your wind direction right. So be wary of setting up on these field edges or these burn edges. Try to find the best trails leading into them and hopefully capitalize before they get there. I hope everybody's locked and loaded and ready to go in the next few weeks. I hope you enjoy this podcast with John Wakefield. Thanks for tuning in. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, good. How you doing?
Oh, I can't complain. What's life like this time of year? Is it a little hot inside and outside? Are you able to stay kind of cool?
Yeah. Hot when we're outside, that's for sure. I get out in the field this time of year doing field visits and checking on units that we've burned this spring and stuff that's coming up for next year. And yeah, I was out yesterday. And it was nice to be out in the field, not in the office, but man, it was hot enough, humid enough.
It's been brutal so, these past few weeks.
Yeah.
So John,
yeah,
why don't you
for sure, but
go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, lots of planning and doing some trainings and stuff this time of year. So okay. You know, it's mix of both office time and field time.
That's good. So, John, why don't you just introduce yourself, kind of, you know, give us a little bit of who you are and, you know, what you're doing with the Game Commission.
Yeah, so my name is John Wakefield. I'm the fire program manager for the Game Commission. Been in this position for 8 years now. Prior to that, I worked at Indiantown Gap as a field forester there. And that's really where I started to get involved with prescribed fire. I grew up in Hummel Sound.
Gotcha.
Right outside of Hershey in central Pennsylvania, and went to Penn State for forestry and spent 2 years at Mount Alto campus, 2 years at Maine. And yeah, got into fire at Indiantown Gap and kind of moved up from there and really honed my interest and gained more experience and was able to bring that to the Game Commission. And here, my main job is to manage all aspects of the prescribed fire program for the agency. So I cover the whole state, manage the qualification system, training. I instruct training classes and schedule training classes, coordinate with other organizations. I mentioned training and qualifications, and that's a big thing for us. We need to meet a set of standards to be able to burn in Pennsylvania, and that's a lot of thing. And working through required experience, there's a whole need to track that to make sure we're all up to par with state standards to be able to do what we're doing. So in addition to that, I am a qualified burn boss. So I'll actually go out throughout the state and lead burn organizations on projects that are, you know, throughout the state in both woods and grasslands. And they range from smaller grass burns to pretty large woods burns. Yeah.
So how long has the state had a burn program in place?
So we've actually been burning for quite a few years, probably back into the 70s and 80s, on a fairly small scale. I'd say our modern day formal prescribed fire program got started in 2009, 2010 timeframe. There was a pretty strong interest to really do more prescribed fire for habitat management, but we had there was sort of a roadblock where there wasn't liability coverage for people to do prescribed fire. And so what really kicked things off for the state as a whole with prescribed fire around 2010 was the passage of the prescribed fire legislation,
okay.
Prescribed Fire Practices Act. and that provided some protection. Burn managers, you know, to go out and burn, as long as they were meeting the standards, they'd be covered for liability. So that was really big in pushing things forward in the state.
Yeah, so how does that work, I guess? That's one question I've always had. I mean, I've talked to a lot of private landowners, and they're like, oh, I'd love to have prescribed fire on my land, but, you know, I don't know anything about it or where to start. I mean, is that something, can private landowners do that, or do they have to have a qualified individual come and write a plan, or how does that work?
Yeah, so private landowners can burn their property. There's nothing against that, as far as the law goes. It's just if something were to happen and fire were to spread onto somebody's land and cause damage, then they could be held liable.
Sure.
But if a landowner's interested in burning their property to improve habitat for hunting or whatever, they could go out and do that. Of course, we recommend that they try to seek out some training or get some information about how to do it safely. And we're working with the Pennsylvania Prescribed Fire Council to try to provide more of that type of training to landowners and folks throughout the state that are interested in seeing more fire on private lands. There's definitely a need there. We recognize that. There's very few contractors that offer services, but that's another option that landowners could go to, is to hire a contractor to come in and burn their property, and they would write a burn plan for that project. So I think we'll see more. Our hope is to see more and more fire getting put on private lands in the future. There's just some things that we'd like to see happen before we really expect a big movement forward with that. Council's working on a certified burn manager program here, hopefully in the next year or two, which will afford liability protection for those who go through this program, which will be very attainable. It'll require a little bit of experience, a little bit of training, but something certainly any landowner could go through. And it's really geared towards teaching, how to do a fire safely, the benefits of fire, what to look for as far as weather and fuel conditions. And we call fuel like leaf litter or grasses, things that are going to carry the fire, what to look for there to be able to have a safe and effective burn. So we want to try to get that information out there to everybody. And that's part of this training. And so we're really excited to get this thing pushed forward and, again, hopefully get some more fire on private lands.
Yeah, that's a great thing. So pretty much anybody listening would be able to say, okay, I'm going to go on and check out the Prescribed Fire Council website and kind of look into that. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah, there will be, as this thing develops, there will be more and more information put out there. In the meantime, we're hoping just to get some basic resources from across the country. There's folks that have put a lot of time into this already and have developed great resources for the public to be able to go and reference on the basics on a prescribed fire, the basic how-tos, getting started with some equipment and things like that. So, yeah, we're hoping to put more of those resources on that website for people to go to and check out. And then as the Certified Burn Manager program starts to take off and become more of a reality, that information will definitely be on there.
Good deal. Well, you made a comment earlier about talking about the benefits of the prescribed fire within that training. So just on a real broad, brief scale, I mean, let's dig into that a little bit. Why fire? Why use fire?
So fire has been around for a long, long time. People like to look at it as a very natural management tool. And there were lightning caused fires historically, and man has used fire as well to shape the land essentially for various purposes. So it's really neat to be able to continue that process and see see basically why everybody has used fire to this point. What kind of benefits you can get specifically from fire that you can't get from other tools, like just cutting or herbicide use. But at the same time, we also think about it as something to go along with those other tools. So fire can do lots of great things, but it also may not be the 100% answer to your habitat needs. So, you know, think about fire in conjunction with cutting timber or herbicide use. So if you combine several of these techniques, you can certainly get a accelerated movement towards your end goal instead of just relying on one tool all the time. Basic things that we like about fire and what it can do for habitat management: it really stimulates browse production. So we're talking about, you know, deer and elk management in particular. Fire top kills a lot of species, saplings to sprout from the ground, and makes those browse shoots a lot more nutritious and preferable by wildlife. We can use fire to top kill and cause a whole bunch of browse to come up. It helps us with oak management. So the way oak grows, it's much slower than, say, birch and maple. Mm-hmm. And oak is fire adapted. It has thick bark. That growth cycle of slow growth is because it puts a lot of its energy into the ground at first. And so we can run a fire through and kill off thin-barked maple and birch and cause the oak to really get ahead of those other species and shoot up and be much more competitive in a forest stand that's regenerating. So from the forestry end of things, that's a big reason why we use fire, is for oak management to keep oak in the picture versus birch and maple.
Okay.
And then as far as grassland management, folks are interested in that. You know, we're looking to keep fields as fields. So if left go, as many people probably know, that a field will revert into brush and eventually into trees. So we're basically resetting the stage and promoting the grass versus encroaching shrubs and trees.
That's interesting. So I, you know, if anybody goes onto the Game Commission website, they can, you know, dig into the habitat management side of things, and they can find the prescribed fire map. It's the ArcGIS platform, GIS platform, and you can see all those units and stuff. So when you look across that whole state, I mean, you zoom out, it's littered all over the state of burns that already occurred and burns that will occur. So you kind of tapped in a little bit to it, but I mean, can you break down like types of habitats and what the goals of the fire? I mean, you've basically got grasslands, and you've probably got some kind of in between, you know, mixed shrubbery early succession state, and then you've just pretty much got closed canopy forests. I mean, if you break it down into those three types of habitats, can you maybe in each of those break down what is benefiting after that fire?
Yeah, sure. So we'll start with grass, and then we'll work into our closed canopy forest. So grass, we're looking to maintain those grasslands, so keeping the shrubs and trees out. We're also removing the thatch buildup. So year after year, if nothing is done, the dead grass material just accumulates at the ground level and makes that grassland pretty unusable to smaller birds, especially when they're, you know, think about them trying to navigate at the ground level. We need to remove that thatch out. So fire does that really effectively. And the other thing I'll say about grassland management is, depending on timing of fire, we either enhance the grass component of that field, or if we burn later in the summer, early fall, we tend to see an increase in the forb component. So your wildflowers or your partridge pea, those type of highly beneficial species will generally increase with that later timed fire. So depending on what the field looks like, we can adjust our timing to meet those needs. We'll move into shrublands, or, you know, earlier successional habitat. So fire is used in those situations to maintain those a lot of times. So it's something that's you know, there's not a whole lot of that out there across the landscape, that, you know, young forest. But certain species definitely need that. And it's, you know, all in all, I'll say it's really important to us in the Game Commission to look at things on a broad scale and really shoot for a mix of structure. As we realize we're not just managing for deer, although maybe a lot of people would just like us to, you know. But we're thinking about bear, and we're thinking about turkey, and you know, we're thinking about keeping fields for pheasants, say. So we're managing a whole host of species, not to mention the non-game species that are out there. You know, a mix of structure, having a little bit of everything in close proximity is probably the best case scenario. So we really don't want a whole landscape all looking the same. So again, with the early successional areas that maybe have been cut or are coming up with saplings, maybe we run a fire through there to just knock that back and let it grow again to be in that a young shrubland or regenerating state.
Yeah, so while you're on that topic, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about those types of species, that woody browse type, you're mostly the species that are there, you're top killing them, and a lot of those species are, you know, coming back from the roots. Or if you continue to burn that type of habitat, do you start to see different plant communities form?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. So one of the things we can do with fire is alter our return interval. So in other words, how often we burn a unit. The more often you burn on a quicker rotation, generally you're going to drive that area to more herbaceous species. You know, grasses are going to start to come in, forbs, things like that, versus a longer fire return interval, you're going to prefer more woody species. So depending on what we're trying to do, we'll change how often we burn an area. We can also, you know, alter fire intensity a little bit there just to achieve those different results. But yeah, if we're burning it, say, every 2 to 3 years, which we have some areas that we try to do that in, we've got a lot to get around to, so it is difficult to stick with that regime. But we have some areas that we've actually targeted on every 3 years, and we've had several burns in, and we can see the results there where the species, the structure is starting to change. Those maple species are getting weeded out. You've got some oaks, you know, really thriving in that condition, and we've got some grasses starting to come in. So again, having all that stuff right there in the same area is really neat. Deer loving it. You know, plenty of places to lay and cover, and plenty of stuff to eat right around. So
sure. Well, hey, before we get too carried away and deep into certain ones, I'll let you go on to kind of that oak forest closed canopy, maybe some of the things that are going in there, the goals there.
Yeah. So as we move into the thinking about forests, generally two different types of forests that we're managing: oak forests and then northern hardwoods types. So we don't have a whole lot of oak, but maybe more
beech, maple type forest.
Beech, birch, maple, yeah, correct. And we've actually used fire in both of those forest types. Oak is the one that gets the most attention because oak is fire adapted. We kind of talked about that earlier. Mm-hmm. But I will mention the northern hardwoods. We've had some areas where we've got a lot of beech brush, and traditionally there's been a lot of herbicide use to try to control that beech brush. But we've been highly effective with fire in controlling that beech brush competition, and also just getting some neat results in the northern hardwood stands as far as seeing some forbs and some grasses coming in, just to kind of diversify things a little bit and provide a little bit more for wildlife. But yeah, something that's kind of out of the box that you might not typically think of, you know, fire in a northern hardwood stand, but I definitely think there's some benefits there that people can think about, and stuff that we've seen, and it's fairly new for us, so we're trying to get our folks from other regions, you know, up to the northeast region, that's where we've been doing some of this kind of test work just to see what'll happen up in Wyoming County.
Okay.
But yeah, stuff's looking really good with that. So it's not like there's a lot of areas where we're just not purposely going to put fire in, specifically some of the northern slope, maybe wetter site, northern hardwood stands. They're just not, very fire receptive. Sure. So we're not going to, you know, focus our time there versus going to a drier site, oak stand, where we're going to have, you know, a lot better results with fire.
So I guess let's just look at it closed canopy forest, regardless of the forest type, whether it's an oak hickory type forest or it's a beech birch maple. If it's a closed canopy forest, are you seeing good regeneration in those units without a lack of sunshine, or is it just a knockback of certain species to promote, you know, better mass crop? Like, you know, I've heard some negative thoughts about some people, and I think it's just their lack of understanding that, you know, there's no benefit in a closed canopy forest. It's a waste of time, but I personally don't agree with that. But can you just kind of highlight why do it in a closed canopy forest as far as maybe beech production or something like that? I mean, what are some of your thoughts on that as far as regeneration?
Yeah, I think light is a huge factor and really important to manage. But I will say, as far as fire in a truly closed canopy stand with lower light levels, some people will take the track of running fire maybe one time through that to knock out the maple saplings or birch saplings that are existing in there before they cut, just to kind of get a head start on things. When other people might go ahead and do a thinning first and let it sprout and then run a fire through. You know, nice thing about doing it before you cut is you don't have a whole lot of the timber slot that could be problematic with a fire. If not handled correctly, you could get a little bit more intensity than what you want and impact your residual trees. But, you know, the other way with cutting it first and then burning is you do have that increased light in there and things are sprouting up, and maybe you get a little bit more benefit from your fire entry in that case. But yeah, ultimately I think having that light in there, it really makes a difference. So whether it's before or after, I think no matter what, you've got to get some light in the stand to really get some regeneration going. So I think if done correctly, I think it can be done either way and still have great results. I'm not saying you have to cut before you burn or you can't burn after you cut, but I think there, depending on your situation and what you're trying to do, fire can be effective in both those cases.
Exactly. And I think you nailed it. I mean, one thing that I want to make sure everybody understands, you know, we talk about managing small parcels. If it's a privately owned parcel for, you know, deer hunting or turkey hunting or whatever, you know, we talk about trying to be as diverse as possible, trying to maximize, diversity, plant species and community types. You know, an uneven canopy, I think, creates a lot of diversity, and that's good for wildlife if managed appropriately. And a lot of people, I think, you know, they'll pick one game lands. Let's say we pick game lands, whatever, in Wyoming County. And, you know, we want to talk negatively about this specific unit, but zoom out to the whole scale of Pennsylvania and think about what we just talked about as far as diversity. You've got different types of habitats, different times of year that you're burning, all trying to be as diverse as possible. So when you zoom out on that scale, I mean, how many different types of manipulations did you just create in a half hour time frame?
Yes. I guess to build on that, I mean, our fire, our burn units specifically are tailored to match the landscape, I'd say, and the size of the land base that we're working on. So how big is the game lands, or you know, how big is the landscape we're talking about? And with the mixing of structure in mind, we don't always want to be going out and burning the entire place. I mean, that's not our goal at all, or burning too big for the size of the game land. So, you know, we're definitely keeping that in mind and scaling our units appropriately. We've got some pretty large game lands, and on those game lands, oftentimes they're kind of inaccessible in terms of timber harvesting, and fire may be the best realistic option for us. And so we may see some pretty large burn units on those places to really have an impact where accessibility is not good and the landscape needs it. 2,000-acre burn unit in one area, and then you go to another game land that's smaller, and maybe we're burning 50-acre woods unit. Yeah, it's a really important concept is to keep it in mind. It's not like cookie cutter across the state.
Yeah, you answered a question I had without really asking it. You know, one of the questions I had was, is bigger better? But keying into that specific habitat type, I think, is spot on. And that's probably what a lot of people don't understand, the relative, you know, relative to that game lands or location and the habitat surrounding that area. You know, I think a lot of people like to think about, you know, a 40-acre section, 100-acre section, small. But really, you guys are managing thousands of acres.
Yeah, tens of thousands of acres on a single game land in some cases. So it's a big area, and we want to have, you know, the most positive impact that we can every time we go out. You know, just jump into it now. For a typical woods burn for us, it's probably 15 to 20 people. And we can have that same crew to burn 50 acres or 200 acres.
Right.
You know, we're obviously from an efficiency standpoint, we're going to, you know, have a lot better impact with the same crew on 200 acres if that's what the habitat calls for. But at the same time, we talk about smaller landowners. There's nothing wrong with starting very small, and I'd encourage that, and you can still see great results. You don't have to think about fire as a tool that, oh, you got to go out and burn 50 acres or 100 acres every time for it to work. You can get really small scale. So people that are thinking about, you know, trying out but maybe aren't sure, you know, like 100 by 100 area or something, you know, just, you know, to start into it. Marcus Lashley out of University of Florida has this
Bo Stan Burns.
Yeah, there you go. I'm sure people have heard about it. That's great. But yeah, you know, now, you know, you're talking about, what, 30 yards around your tree stand type of small scale. But right there, I mean, that's his point about fire. Fire doesn't need to be, you know, this thing that people think about that only the public agencies can do. I mean, it's something doable. You know, again, get your done on it and do it safely. But it can be used on those smaller scales.
Certainly. So you talked a little bit earlier in the podcast about, you know, burning and heat intensity and time of year. Let's dig into a little bit of that. What is making you guys decide when to burn, whether it's in that, you know, late February time frame through April into May versus doing it in the dormant season, you know, here in, you know, mid hunting season or something like that?
We look for opportunities 12 months out of the year. Now, of course, we don't get them, but we've got so much to do that we have to be thinking about fire in some manner all year. And we've actually been able to burn in every month except for January so far. So we'll keep looking at that one. But yeah, anyway, weather is the biggest factor, of course. We generally get the best conditions, it's maybe starting late February in through May. And that is generally due to weather conditions, the drier air, drier humidity that comes through Pennsylvania. But in our wooded stands, it's before leaf on. So once things really start greening up, depending on where you're at in the state, May into June, that's when we kind of shut for a couple of months in the summer for our woods burns anyway.
Okay.
And then once the leaves come off in the fall, we get into that window of opportunity again. And of course, you know, snowpack and not only the snow itself, but snow packs the leaves down after it's on. So we have to wait till that stuff kind of fluffs up till it gets to burn right for us again. But aside from that, it'll be dependent on what our objectives are. So if we, you know, I kind of mentioned before about the grass side of things, about when you burn, you know, woods burns, we try to get them in whenever we can, February to early May. We have to start watching our intensities with ambient air temperatures and leaf out. As we get into May, we start to get more of an impact with fire once the buds start to break, we start to get some leaves on. The other consideration for us being a wildlife agency is nesting season and fawning season. So as we start to get into May, that's a big consideration for us. And so we realize we may, you know, impact a couple turkey nests, say, from time to time. For one, as we come across those, we can successfully protect those nests a lot of times. But if we can't, you know, our stance is if we impact a few nests, the habitat benefit from what we did will be a lasting effect that the turkey will be able to enjoy for years and years. So kind of for the greater good type of view. But also, so people know, turkey will re-nest. There's lots of papers out there, documentation, even through National Wild Turkey Federation, that supports fire even into that May time period, you know, or early in the nesting season, just to kind of push the effects of fire on the habitat versus maybe those few losses. So,
yeah, I mean, it's kind of it's a double-edged sword, but I mean, people got to understand right. that, you know, you guys aren't just when the situation's right, you're not just going out and you're just burning. There's a plan of going through and setting your fire breaks and probably going through the unit to a degree just to make sure that everything's in check.
Yes, we have a pretty extensive process for each and every burn that we do. Every burn unit needs to have a burn plan, and those plans are really comprehensive. It'll take our staff a good amount of time, hours and hours, to put these plans together. And that covers all of our bases, from our notifications before the burn, leading up to the burn, people that we need to notify about what we're doing, fire breaks, where they're going, schedule for maintenance of those, what our weather conditions need to be, what our objectives are for doing the burn, how many people we need, how many engines we need to be able to hold the fire, our smoke concerns. We really don't want to impact the public with our smoke. So we have a certain set of conditions that we need to meet to be able to do that. And then if something happens during the burn that doesn't go the way that we want it to, what's our contingency plan for handling that? So that's all outlined along with maps and everything like that for every plan. So it's a pretty well thought out process, well in advance. I review all of those plans through my position here in Harrisburg and sign off on all of them. So yeah, it's definitely a lot goes into each burn.
So one big question I have, are you guys finding that you are able to control or suppress invasive species with the use of fire?
Yeah, invasive is an interesting one. I'll say it depends on the invasive species that you're concerned with. So things like fern and stiltgrass, mile a minute, we cannot control with fire. We haven't necessarily seen where fire by itself has contributed to, say, a rapid expansion of the coverage of those species. A lot of it is tied to light. And so if you're opening up the stand, whether it's with fire or another practice, you're likely going to see an expansion of those type of invasives. You know, other invasive shrubs, barberry, we've actually been able to at least top kill barberry, sometimes outright kill barberry with fire. Ailanthus, you'll see the root suckering off ailanthus, so it's definitely recommended to treat that ahead of time. If it's on your property, get out and treat the ailanthus if you're thinking about using fire, just so you don't have that type of explosion. And it's the same as you would if you just cut it and didn't herbicide it. So it's kind of a mixed bag with fire. So it all depends on what you got and, you know, what you're trying to do. But I would definitely recommend identifying those issues up front and be thinking about herbicide to really knock them out so they don't become more problematic.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, if you run into those situations where you're going to burn a lot of that matter, thatch that's in your area that you're going to burn, right after that would probably be a good time to then treat with herbicide to prevent those from coming back and let those new species kind of overcrowd that. Is that accurate?
Yeah. We've had great success. Of course, we've done some experimenting with different herbicides, but you know, definitely plan on it and be prepared to treat those after a fire. We've had some grass fields where they were pretty overridden with Japanese stiltgrass. Mm-hmm. So we've burned the field off, and then we've applied a pre-emergent herbicide, and have totally knocked it out, and that grass has come back in and dominated again. So I think in the case of stiltgrass in particular, it's important to think about what's going to replace it. What do you want to have there to outcompete it? Because I think with some of these herbicide treatments for like fern and stiltgrass, it's only going to buy you a little bit of time, but you got to have something there to replace it. And ideally something, you know, native, beneficial. So
what about your other, like, non-targeted or non-preferred species, like striped maple that you're seeing in places in the northern woods? Does that set it back, or does that pretty much come back from the roots then?
No, striped maple is one that we can impact with fire for sure. You know, even if it's just top killing. Again, we're giving our preferred species a chance to get ahead. So you know, even if it's top killing these species, you're getting other stuff up above it that could eventually outcompete it. So yeah, that's a pretty solid target with fire in oak stands. If they got a lot of striped maple underneath, running a nice, you know, low to moderate intensity fire in there should do the trick.
You know, the concepts that we're talking about to try to manage preferred species, they're really not much different than what I'm used to in my profession in agriculture. You know, we're trying to prepare the seed bed to make a clean field come up for any of our row crops. And the earlier and more consistent that you manage those less desirable weeds, it's going to be a whole lot easier because your species that you're wanting to flourish will, once they have that early competition removed.
Right.
You know, it seems like in a lot of those forests like situations.
Don't wait till it's like, you know, crazy out of control to do something. If you recognize the problem, try to address it up front. That's going to be the best.
Exactly. So one thing I wanted to make sure I understood. So, you know, a lot of those springtime or dormant season, you know, late season, so let's say November, and then those early March time frames, those fires are the ones that you're kind of burning a lot of that material off the thatch, and it's just kind of getting new growth. But the more intense growing season fires, you're having a greater effect on maybe hardwood species, but the plant communities are switching. Is that kind of understood right?
Yeah, we're seeing in general, you'll see a greater impact with fire during the growing season, whether it's early growing season or late growing season, because everything's leafed out, and it doesn't take a whole lot of fire to at that point with higher air temperatures to be cooking sap. So in general, like late growing season fires, or you know, fires kind of later in May, they're often not as intense, but you get a little bit more severity, we call it, a little bit more impact out of that. You could get similar results in the dormant season, but you're probably going to need a little bit higher intensity fire.
Right. Oh, man, we kind of bounced all over the place, John. I mean, is there anything that I'm missing or things that you want to touch on about the fire program?
Yeah, I will say, as far as hunters that are interested in where we're burning, and I guess we'll just kind of jump into burning during the fall, burning during hunting season. We do that. like I said before, we try to burn whenever we can meet objectives. And so that includes archery season. So coming up here in the next couple of months, you might see signs on game lands, notice prescribed fire area. There might be a date change there. Let's just let you know, just to check in on our public website, our prescribed fire page, and check that map. And that map will be updated once burns are going to happen, for sure. So like day before, you know, they'll get posted on there, possibly a couple of days out, but it's tough to get more than that because of you know, the way weather changes. So those burns will be updated on there. So, you know, be sure to keep a heads up for that. The other thing that we're looking to do is roll out a kind of a sign-up listserv where you can sign up if you're interested in knowing when we're going to burn in a particular county.
Okay.
That you might get a text message or an email or both. I'm not exactly sure. I'm pretty sure it's one or both of those. But anyway, it's another way to be able to get the message out to the public about what we're doing to try to reduce conflicts.
Sure, so, I'm sure you get plenty of those.
Yeah, it's something that we tested this spring in Lehigh County and had good success with over there. So we're looking to roll it out statewide. It is not live yet, but there'll be information coming out soon about that. I'm not sure if we'll have it totally live this fall, but definitely by spring, you'll be able to sign up for that. So keep that in mind. Something else I just thought of is a perception that once an area is burned, there's not going to be any wildlife in it till next year. That's not true.
We've seen
turkey and deer coming in to check it out, like right after we've burned it, when there's even still some smoke coming off. And we've had some hunters who have been successful in units that were burned like the week before. You know, really, if you think about it, it's something new, something different for the wildlife. And I think generally they're attracted to that. They're going to be curious. They're going to go in and check some stuff out. You know, it's not going to have all the browse, obviously, like it would the following year. But the interesting thing that we have seen is that in oak stands, you know, fire will uncover acorns. So it takes the leaf litter off and you're left with a whole bunch of exposed acorns. So, you know, it's just kind of something that's maybe a little bit different and gets the attention of deer and turkey who are coming through there. So something to think about.
That's a great point. And I mean, you think about the insect communities that are exposed for all types of birds,
bugs,
including
bugs
turkeys.
Bugs are going to be available. Yeah.
Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of the Woodsman Podcast. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.